Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I am your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on 29 AM and FM radio stations 7 days a week in the United States and in more than 70 countries worldwide on the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and the Editorial Review, please visit my webpage. That's georgegordon.org. Again, georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law news and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on the immigrant gang plague when we return right after this. Well, Joe Smith started the day early, having set his alarm clock made in Japan for 6 a.m. while his coffee pot made in Japan is perking. He puts his blow dryer made in Taiwan to work, and then he shaves with his electric razor made in Hong Kong. Then he puts on a dress shirt made in Taiwan, his designer jeans made in Singapore, and a pair of tennis shoes made in Korea. You know, after cooking up some breakfast in his new electric skillet made in the Philippines, he sits down to figure out on his calculator made in Mexico how much he can spend today. Then after setting his watch made in Switzerland to the radio made in Hong Kong, he goes out and gets in his car made in Germany, goes looking, as he has for many months, for a good-paying American job. Then after the end of another discouraging and fruitless day, Joe decides to relax for a while, so he puts on a pair of sandals made in Brazil, pours himself a glass of wine made in France, turns on his TV made in Japan, and then ponders again why he can't find a good-paying American job. Now, instead of a good-paying American job, why doesn't Joe look for a good-paying American private business dealing in property instead of income? Now, if you'd like to tap into the power of private business, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package? That's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. It's informative, entertaining, it's educational. Remember, it's free of charge. You can call right now to order yours. The number to call, 417-273-4967. If you're online, just go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. Why don't you do it right now before you forget, or call direct, 417-273-4967. Well, before immigration optimists issue another rosy prognosis for America's multicultural future, they might want to visit Belmont High School in Los Angeles. It's overwhelmingly Hispanic, gang-ridden, and it's a gang-ridden, rampant district. Upward and onward is not a phrase that comes to mind when speaking to the first and second generation immigrant teens milling around the school. Most of the people that I used to hang out with when I first came to the school have dropped out, observes Jackie. She's a vivacious, illegal alien from Guatemala. Others got kicked out or into drug gangs. Five graduated and four homegirls got pregnant. Certainly none of the older teens that I met outside of Belmont was on track to graduate. Jackie herself flunked ninth grade. She said, "I used to ditch a lot and never caught up." She's now pursuing a general equivalency diploma. That's a watered-down certificate for dropouts or expelled students in the school's adults division. Vanessa, who sports a tiny horseshoe protruding from her nostrils, is applying to the adult division too, having been kicked out of Belmont at age 18. "I didn't come to school very often," says this American-born child of illegal aliens from El Salvador. Her boyfriend, Albert, a dashing 19-year-old with long, slicked back black hair, got expelled for truancy, but has talked his way back into the regular high school. "I have good manipulative skills," he smiles. After a robbery conviction, Albert was put on probation, but he broke every rule in the book: curfews, grades, attendance, missed court dates, he boasts, "but they still let me off the hook." These Belmont teens are no aberration. Hispanic youths, whether recent arrivals or birthright American citizens, are developing into an underclass culture. By Hispanic here, I mean the population originating in Latin America. and above all in Mexico, as distinct from America's much smaller Puerto Rican and Dominican communities out of the Caribbean Sea or the Caribbean descent, which have themselves long shown elevated crime and welfare rates. Hispanic school dropout rates and teen birth rates are now the highest in the nation. Gang crime is exploding nationally, rising 50% from 1999 to 2002. Now picture that. 1999 to 2002, gang crime is up 50%, driven by the march of Hispanic immigration east and north across the country. And most worrisome, underclass indicators like crime and single parenthood do not improve over successive generations of Hispanics. Instead, they worsen. Debate has recently heated up over whether Mexican immigration, unique in its scale and in other important ways, will in fact defeat the American tradition of assimilation. The rise of underclass behavior among the progeny of Mexicans and other Central Americans must be a part of that debate. There may be assimilation going on, but a significant portion of it is assimilation downward to the worst elements of American life. To be sure, most Hispanics are hardworking, law-abiding residents. They have reclaimed squalid neighborhoods in South Central Los Angeles and elsewhere. Now, among the dozens of Hispanic youths that I interviewed, several expressed gratitude for the United States, a sentiment that would be hard to find among the ordinary run of teenagers. But given the magnitude of present immigration levels, if only a portion of those from south of the border goes bad, the costs to society will become enormous. The Soledad Enrichment Action Charter School in South Central Los Angeles is at the vortex of the Los Angeles gang culture. Next door to a rose-colored, angel-bedecked church, the boxy school glowers behind barred gates like those that surround prisons. Soledad students, about half black and half Hispanic, have been kicked out of other schools. They have brought violence with them. In early March, a gunman opened fire on 20 students entering the school at 7:30 a.m., wounding two. Tensions were high again as school let out one day this April. A boy had been sent home earlier for fighting. The question now was, would he return to retaliate? And if he did, would he bring a gun and start shooting people? The school's probation officer radioed the Los Angeles Police Department's 77th Division to plead for some officers to keep watch, and without success. As the students dressed in plain white t-shirts filed out to the sidewalk, two burly security guards and a gang counselor warily eyed the street. When asked about gangs, the teens proudly reeled off their affiliations. SOK, still out killing. HTO, Hispanics taking over. JMC, just mobbing crazy. A cocky American-born child of Salvadorian parents says that most of his peers from the eighth grade are either locked up or dead. Four are dead, three were shot, one was run over. Were you just lucky, I asked? They were gang-banging more than me, says the 17-year-old, who won't give his name. I try to control myself, respect my parents. That respect only goes so far. Asked if he's been in jail, he swaggers, yep, for GTA, Grand Theft Auto. And he has no intention of leaving his gang. They're the homies, part of my family. 18-year-old Eric, born here to an illegal Mexican and Guatemalan, is one of the few students that I talk to who doesn't gangbang. Though he's on probation for second-degree robbery, his second conviction, half of his friends from elementary school are involved in crime, he says, and of course, gang problems in Los Angeles schools are hardly confined to academics. For delinquents like Soledad, Gang fights in some of LA's regular high schools draw such crowds that youthful pickpockets have a field day working the spectators and participants. People would steal your papers and cell phones, reports one student who has bounced through several schools. David O'Connell, the pastor of the church next door to Soledad, has been fighting LA's crime culture for over a decade. He rues the ferocious stuff that is currently coming out of Central America, sounding weary and pessimistic. But what's more frightening, he says, is the disengagement from adults. Hispanic children feel that they have to deal with problems themselves, apart from their parents, according to O'Connell, and they do so in violent ways. The adults, for their part, start to fear young people, including their own children. The pull to a culture of violence among Hispanic children begins earlier and earlier, O'Connell says. Researchers and youth workers across the country confirm his observation. In Chicago, gangs start recruiting kids at age 9. And according to criminologists studying policing and social trends in the Windy City, the Chicago Community Policing Evaluation Consortium concluded that gangs have become fully integrated into Hispanic youth culture. Even children not in gangs emulate their attitudes, dress, and self-presentation. The result is a community in thrall. Non-affiliated children fear traveling into unknown neighborhoods and sometimes drop out of school for lack of protection. Adults are just as scared. They may know who has been spray painting their garage, for example, but they will not tell the police for fear that their car will be torched in retaliation. It's like we're in our own little jails that we can't leave, said one resident. There isn't an uninfested place anywhere in Los Angeles. Washington, D.C. reports the same ever younger phenomenon. Recruitment is starting early in middle school, says Lori Kaplan, the head of D.C.'s Latin American Youth Center. With early recruitment comes a high school dropout rate of about 50%. Gang culture is gaining more recruits than our ability to get kids out. We can get this kid out, but two or three will take his place. In May, an 18-year-old member of the Salvadoran Mara gang used a machete to chop off four left fingers and nearly sever the right hand of a 16-year-old Southside Locos rival in the Washington suburbs. Ernesto Vega, a 19-year-old Mexican illegal who grew up in New York City, estimates that most 12 to 14-year-old Mexicans and Mexican-Americans in New York are in gangs for protection. If you're a Mexican, you can't go to parties by yourself, he says. People will ask, who you down with? Cui barrio? They're checking. They're checking you out. But if it's 20 of you and 20 of them, then it's okay. For some children, the choice is to get beat up at least once a week or get beat up once to enter the gang. Others join for the prestige and sense of belonging. Now, Mario Flores was one of them. He joined Santa Ana, California's West Side Compadres. He did it when he was 13. I was like, wow. I wanted them to jump me. He says in the soft, near whisper of the cool, they're like, you want to get down. They got to jumping at you. They go to call you. Trips from West Side Comps. You feel good. Let me pause here. Did you hear that? They got to jumping at you. They go to call you. Trips from West Side Comps. You feel good. Is that the kind of language that's going to get you a job at IBM or General Motors or Ford? You know, Bill Cosby made the same observation with black youth that they want to join the counterculture so that they can be cool, be one of the insiders. But that's not what American business is looking for. And that's why they're unemployed and unemployable. Hang on, I'll be right back. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week on the Internet. And for more information about the Gordon Law School and Law Hour, please go to the website at georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. And the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has a radio log schedule and archives, and it can be accessed through my website at georgegordon.org. All right, we're talking about gangs, American gangs. They are Hispanic gangs and gang wars. For some children, the choice is you either get up once a week or you get beat up once when you join the gang. Flores, or Trips as they call him, is a depressing specimen of gang culture. He's uneducated and barely articulate. He's sitting on the other side of a plexiglass window in the Santa Ana Central Jail, talking to me over a telephone, in and out of jail with dazzling regularity over the past 3 years. He most recently left prison on April the 14th. Then on April the 21st, he was arrested again on a rape charge. Trips was born in Portland, Oregon, but raised in Mexico. Flores went to live with cousins in San Bernardino, California at age 13 and has been traveling the Southern California gang circuit ever since. That's in Riverside County, Santa Ana, East L.A. Now, age 20, he's slender and finely chiseled. Gang hand gestures accompany his speech like hieroglyphics. When I saw gang members, he says, pointing first to his eyes, then outward, they're like, "Are you going down with my S?" "I'm down." I ask if he speaks English or Spanish with this gang. He said, "You speak Chicano." "Hey, homie, you mostly talk English. You've got some good words, but the way you talk, you don't talk good. You don't talk like other people," he said. Flores expresses the fierce attachment to territory that is the sine qua non of gang identity. He said, "I was like, I love my neighborhood. If you don't love my neighborhood, I'm going to blank you up." Charles Beck, captain of the LAPD's Rampart Division, marvels at his emotion. They all come from identical neighborhoods, identical families, and go to identical schools, and yet they hate each other with a passion. "The territorial instincts can only be compared to the Balkans," says Corporal Kevin Ruiz. He's a Santa Ana gang investigator. "There's people who all they do is patrol gang boundaries. They're like me in a way. I'm looking for bad guys. They look for rivals." Trips showed his love for Santa Ana's West Side compadres by doing missions. Missions like robbing bars, stealing wallets and cell phones, selling drugs to raise money for the gang. "If a big homie told me to blank someone, then I had to," explain. "The gang reciprocated by giving him a place to stay when he was bringing in cash. Otherwise, he lived in cars or on the street, sometimes in a hotel." The chance that Flores will ever become a productive member of society is remote. Routinely kicked out of high school for fighting, he lacks rudimentary skills. And like many prisoners, he claims to be reading the Bible and thanking Jesus. But such prison conversions rarely last. His personal life is troubled. "My lady, she mad at me," not surprisingly given his most recent rape charge. "And Flores is not certain that she will be waiting for him when he gets out of jail." Most likely, Flores will continue contributing to the Hispanicization of prisons in California. In 1970, Hispanics were 12% of the state's population and 16% of new prison admittances. By 1998, they were 30% of California's population and 42% of the new admittance. Even as it reaches down to ever younger recruits, gang culture is growing more lethal. In April, 16-year-old Valentino Arenas drove up to a courthouse in Pomona, California, and shot to death a randomly chosen California State Highway Patrol officer in the hope of gaining entry to Pomona's 12th Street gang. The assassination wouldn't surprise Dennis Farrell. He's a Nassau County, New York homicide detective. "We're amazed at the openness of these shootings," he says. "When we do cases which involve Hispanic gangs, we often get full statements of admission, almost like they don't see what's the big deal." The unwritten code that moderated gang violence three or four decades ago has now fallen away. "When I grew up," says Santa Ana native and gang investigator Kevin Ruiz, "there were rules of engagement, no shooting at churches or at home. Now, no one is immune." One of Ruiz's colleagues on the Santa Ana police force, Mona Ruiz, who's no relation, spent her adolescence in Santa Ana gangs. Now, she tries to get kids out. "Back then," she says, "if someone got jumped, you responded with fistfights, not guns." Guns started in the 1980s. Earlier, gangbangers even showed a certain fastidiousness of dress. "Guys used to iron their jeans for 2 hours," Mona Ruiz recalls. "Then they wouldn't sit down to avoid marring the crease. All that's changed when heroin hit," she says. The constant invasion of illegal aliens is worsening gang violence as well. In Phoenix, Arizona, and surrounding Maricopa County, illegal alien gangs such as Brown Pride and Wetback Power are growing more volatile and more dangerous, according to Tom Barrett, a former sheriff's department official and current candidate for sheriff. Even in prison, where they clash with American Hispanics, they are creating a more vicious environment. Upward mobility to the suburbs doesn't necessarily break the allure of gang culture either. An immigration agent reports that the middle-class suburbs of southwest Miami, second and third generation Hispanic youths are perpetrating home invasions, robberies, battery, drug sales, and rape. Kevin Ruiz knows students at the University of California at Irvine who retain their gang connections. Prosecutors in formerly crime-free Ventura County, California, sought an injunction this May against the Colonia Cheeks gang after homicides rocketed up. An affidavit supporting the injunction details how Cheeks members terrorize the local hospital whenever one of their gang members arrives with a gunshot wound. Federal law enforcement officials in Virginia are tracking with alarm the spread of gang violence from northern Virginia west into the Shenandoah Valley and south toward Charlottesville, a trend so disturbing that they secured federal funds this May to staunch the mayhem. "This is beyond a regional problem. It is, in fact, a national problem," said FBI Assistant Director Michael Mason. He's the head of the Bureau's Washington field office. Open borders apologists dismiss the Hispanic crime threat by observing that black crime rates are even higher. That's true, but it's irrelevant. The black population is not growing, whereas the Hispanic immigration is reaching virtually every part of the country, sometimes radically changing local demographics. With a felony arrest rate up to triple that of whites, Hispanics can dramatically rise or raise community crime levels. Many cops and youth workers blame the increase in gang appeal on the disintegration of the Hispanic family. The trends are worsening, especially for United States-born Hispanics. In California, 67% of children of U.S.-born Hispanic parents lived in an intact family in 1990. But by 1999, that number had dropped to 56%. The percentage of Hispanic children living with a single mother in California rose from 18% in 1990 to 29% in 1999. Nationally, single-parent households constituted 25% of all Hispanic households with minor children in 1980. By the year 2000, the proportion had jumped to 34%. Now, the trends in teen parenthood, the marker of underclass behavior, will almost certainly affect the crime and gang rate. Hispanics now outrank blanks for teen births. Mexican teens have higher birth rates than Puerto Ricans, previously the most ghettoized Hispanic subgroup in terms of welfare use and out-of-wedlock child rearing. In 2002, there were 83.4 births per 1,000 Hispanic females between ages 15 and 19, compared with 66.6 among blacks, 28.5 among non-Hispanic whites, and 18.3 among Asians. Perhaps these young Hispanic mothers are giving birth as wives. Very unlikely. In California, where Latina teens have the highest birth rate of teens in any state, 79% of teen births to U.S.-born Latinos in 1999 were to unmarried girls. Now, according to the many young Hispanics that I spoke to, more and more girls are getting pregnant. This year was the worst for pregnancy, says La Linea, an American-born senior at Manual Arts High School near downtown Los Angeles. A lot of girls get abortions. Some drop out. Are girls ashamed when they get pregnant? I wonder. Not at all, Lalina responds. Among Hispanic teens, at least, if not among their parents, the stigma of single parenthood has totally vanished. I asked Jackie, the Guatemalan GED student at LA's Belmont High, if her pregnant girlfriends subsequently got married, and she laughed. George, an 18-year-old of Salvadoran background who was kicked out of Manual Arts 6 months ago for a vicious fight, estimates that most girls at the school are having sex by age 16. Mexican and Central American immigration to New York City is of much more recent vintage than in California, but young Mexicans in New York have quickly assimilated to underclass sexual behavior. 19-year-old Ernesto Vega reports that his oldest sister dropped out of school at age 17, got pregnant the next year. I heard her boyfriend came from Mexico to work, but he wasn't working. He was on the street, Ernesto says. Then the boyfriend got arrested, probably on drug charges, and he says he was arrested for doing nothing. But they don't arrest you for doing nothing, do they? Ernesto knows three or four Mexican-American girls with babies, including a 16-year-old with two daughters. Another just got pregnant this year, he says. She's 15. None of them is married. None has a GED or a high school diploma or will go to college. As for the fathers of their children, the boys be leaving the girls alone, Vega says. The boy goes away. Some Hispanic parents valiantly try to impose old-fashioned consequences on teen pregnancies, but they're losing the battle. Vega's father, a building superintendent and hardware store clerk, angrily told his pregnant daughter, according to Vega, "You got to go live with the boyfriend. I now want nothing to do with you. You boyfriend offered to take the girl into the apartment he was sharing with a female acquaintance, but she wanted her own place." And eventually she persuaded her father to take her back, but only on the condition that she work. She now sells Yankee paraphernalia on the Grand Concourse in the Bronx. Well, it's either welfare, or what's the obvious other solution? Crime, drugs, and gangs, isn't it? Well, hang on, we'll be back with more on gangs when we return. Stand by. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, under the terms of a contract called the Old Covenant, negotiated by Moses out at Mount Sinai, you and I are entitled to 33 articulable benefits. Benefits such as rain in due season, multiplied gold, silver, herds, flocks, and great wealth. Well, George Bush, both Bushes, senior and junior, said that what Americans wanted was jobs, jobs, jobs. But that's not what George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Ben Franklin, Moses, or God had in mind when they wrote our Constitution, Bill of Rights, or the Ten Commandments. All of these authorities recognize that real wealth is measured in land, cattle, property, gold, silver, wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil. It's not measured in jobs, jobs, jobs. And that's because there's no money in employment. The money is in private business. The money is in sales. The money is in property. But there's no money in public business or jobs, jobs, jobs. Now it's time that you cashed in on your inheritance and learned how to collect those benefits of the Old Covenant contract and get paid in gold, silver, wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil, in real property instead of credit, debt, usury, inflation, and worthless paper. Now, if you'd like to learn how to do just that, why don't you call for more information on my CD Home School for Adults and then order my free General Law CD package at the same time. Now, that's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's informative, entertaining, it's educational, it's free. And you can call right now to order yours. The number to call is 417-273-4967. If you're online, you can go to my website, georgegordon.org, click onto the email, and send me an email request for that free General Law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. Well, traditional and contemporary family values continued to clash throughout the pregnancy, and although the boyfriend vanished until the birth, he showed up at Vega's house with his whole family when the girl returned from the hospital with her newborn. He took his three sisters and his mother. One sister took the nephews, Vega recalls, and the boyfriend's demand, "You have to decide where to live." The girl told him to take a hike. The family delegation, Vega judges, already adapting to American individualist norms, was inappropriate. The problem was not with the families, he says, but between him and her. In one respect, Central American immigrants break the mold of traditional American underclass behavior. They work. But even so, Mexican welfare receipt is twice as high as that of natives, in large part because Mexican-American incomes are so low and remain low over successive generations. Disturbingly, welfare use actually rises between the second and third generation to 31% of all third-generation Mexican-American households. Illegal Hispanics make liberal use of welfare also by putting their American-born children on public assistance. In Orange County, California, for instance, nearly twice as many Hispanic welfare cases are for children of illegal aliens as for legal families. Even more troubling, some Hispanics combine work with gang banging. Gang detectives in Long Island's Suffolk County know when members of the violent Salvadoran MS-13 gang get off work from their lawn maintenance or pizzeria jobs and can follow them to their gang meetings. Mexican gang members in rural Pennsylvania, which saw 2 gang homicides in late April, also often work in landscaping and construction. On the final component of underclass behavior, school failure, Hispanics are in a class all by themselves. No other group drops out in greater numbers. In Los Angeles, only 48% of Hispanic ninth graders graduate from high school, compared with a 56% citywide graduation rate and a 70% nationwide rate. In 2000, nearly 30% of Hispanics between the ages of 16 and 24 were high school dropouts nationwide, compared with about 13% of blacks and 7% of whites. The constant inflow of barely literate recent Mexican arrivals unquestionably brings down Hispanic education levels. But later, American-born generations do not brighten the picture much either. While Mexican Americans make significant education gains between the first and second generation, adding 3.5 years of schooling, progress stalls in the next generation. And economists Jeffrey Groger and Stephen Trejo have found third-generation Mexican Americans remain three times as likely to drop out of high school than whites, and 1.5 times as likely to drop out as blacks. They complete college at 1/3 the rate of whites. Mexican Americans are assimilating, not into the national schooling average, observed the Federal Research Bank of Dallas this June, but into the dramatically lower Hispanic average. In educational outcomes, concluded the bank, ethnicity is what matters. Now, no one knows why this is so. Every parent that I spoke to said that she wanted her children to do well in school and then go to college. Yet the message is often not getting across. Hispanic parents are the kind of parents that leave it to others, explains an unwed Salvadoran welfare mother in Santa Ana. We don't get that involved. A news director of a Southern California Spanish radio station expresses frustration at the passivity toward education and upward mobility that he sees in his own family. I tried to knock the Spanglish accent out of my niece and to get rid of that crap, he says. But the mother was completely nihilistic about her child. It's going to take direct action from Americans to Americanize Hispanics, he said. Perhaps the answer to the disconnect between stated parental goals and educational outcomes lies in Hispanic culture's traditional suspicion of education. Santa Ana police officer Mona Ruiz recounts a joke told by comedian George Lopez. He said, when a white person graduates, people say, you did good. When a Mexican graduates, people say, you think you're better than us. The lure of an immediate income often proves more compelling than a 4 to 8 year investment in self-improvement. New Yorker Ernesto Vega says that he knows Mexicans with papers who drop out of high school. They young, he say. I'm going to start working. I don't need school. But Vega has no illusions about the consequences. Even with papers, you're only making $300 a week as a delivery boy in restaurants because you don't know anything else. Proponents of unregulated immigration simply ignore the growing underclass problem among later generations of Hispanics. With its attendant gang involvement and teen pregnancy, when pressed, open borders advocates dismiss worries about the Hispanic future with their favorite comparison between Mexicans and Italians, popularized by political analyst Michael Barron in The New Americans. The analogy goes something like this. A century ago, Italian immigrants anticipated the Mexican influx, above all in their disregard for education. They dropped out of school in high numbers, and yet they eventually prospered and joined the mainstream. Therefore, argue Barron and others, Mexicans will do it also. But this analogy is flawed. To begin with, the magnitude of Mexican immigration renders all historical comparisons totally irrelevant. As Harvard historian Samuel Huntington argues in his latest books, Who Are We? In the year 2000, Mexicans constituted nearly 30% of the foreign-born population in the United States. The next two largest groups were the Chinese at 5%, the Filipinos at 4%. Well, by contrast, at the turn of the 20th century, the largest immigrant group, Germans, made up only 15% of the foreign-born population. In 1910, Great Britain, Germany, Ireland, and Italy, in that order, sent the most immigrants to the United States. Italians made up only 17% of the combined total. English speakers made up over half of the new arrivals. There was no chance that Italian would become the dominant language in any part of the country. By contrast, half of today's immigrants speak Spanish. Now take a look at the paperwork that you get from government. It's written in both Spanish and English. Equally important, the flow of these newcomers came to an abrupt halt after World War I and did not resume until 1965. This long pause allowed the country ample opportunity to Americanize the foreign-born and their children. Today, no end is in sight to the migration from Mexico and its neighbors, which continually reinforces Mexican culture in American Hispanic cultures, not American culture, and it seems likely to do so for decades to come into the future. America is not Americanizing these new immigrants. These new immigrants are bringing Spanish and Hispanic culture to America, not the other way around. Contemporary Hispanic immigration also differs from the classic Ellis Island model in that the ease of cross-border travel and communication allows Mexican and Central American immigrants to keep at least one foot planted in their native Mexico. Meanwhile, the Mexican government does everything that it can to bind Mexican migrants psychologically to their home country in order to safeguard the annual $12 billion a year flow of remittances of American dollars to Mexico. And it encourages this dual nationality. The Mexicans in the United States can now run for office in Mexico. A Yolo County, California tomato farmer has already been elected mayor of Jerez. Not surprisingly, Mexicans and other Central Americans have the lowest rates of naturalization of all immigrants, less than 30% in 1990, compared with two-thirds of qualified immigrants from major European countries, the Philippines and Hong Kong. Even Mexico's former foreign minister, Jorge Castaneda, acknowledges the unprecedented character of Hispanic immigration. Mexican immigration, he wrote recently, does not have distinctive traits that do make assimilation difficult, if not impossible. This is a matter of history, he says. That history holds that the U.S. robbed Mexico of its natural territory in the 19th century, as some Mexican immigrants never seem to forget. It is kind of scary, says Santa Ana Gang Intervention Officer Mona Ruiz. I was here first. This used to be Mexico. You stole it from us. Mexican-American Ruiz is herself called a traitor for becoming an American citizen. While proponents of the Reconquista of Alta California, as Mexican nationalists call the lost territory of California, are a small minority of Hispanic immigrants, a much larger proportion hold on to their Hispanic identities. Few of the American-born students that I spoke to in Southern California identified themselves as American. Many said that they were Mexican, Latino, or Mexican-American. Usages encouraged by the multicultural dogma in the schools, which is a far cry from the Americanization efforts of classrooms a century ago. The Spanish language media, which reaches two-thirds of all Hispanics, reinforces the sense of grievance. Stories about America's cruelties to immigrants and the country's shocking failure to legalize illegal aliens dominates news coverage in the Spanish radio and Spanish media. A billboard for Los Angeles Spanish newspaper La Opinion conveys the usual tone. Justice, abuse, deportation, and other hot-button topics blare out in massive lettering. All right, hang on. We'll be right back with more right after this. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Back in 1787, the writers of our Constitution put in this clause at Article 1, Section 10. It says, no state shall make anything but gold or silver coin attender in payment of debt. Now that clause follows the biblical injunction that we see in just weights and balances in Leviticus 19, verses 35 and 36. And private business is carried on in gold and silver coin, but public business is conducted in commercial paper like stocks, bonds, and Federal Reserve notes, credit cards, debt, and usury. Well, back in 1965, Congress said that there's no difference in the value of gold and silver coin and clad coin or currency. And that's very true when you're dealing with banks, government, and commercial industry. But you know, out here in the real marketplace, there's a 7-to-1 difference in purchasing power and a 7-to-1 difference in the taxes due on that paper money over gold and silver coin. Now, God and our founding fathers did not give us gold and silver coin for no good purpose. They knew as a matter of law that gold and silver coin was absolutely essential for us to deal in order to establish our property rights. Well, neither did our Congress and politicians take our gold and silver coin away from us for no good reason either. They knew, and they knew full well back in 1933, that in order to subjugate the American people, they would first have to take away our gold and silver coin so that they could take away our right to property and to destroy our property rights, which is precisely what the first plank to the Communist Manifesto calls for, and it's what it's done. So if you and I intend to regain our rights, duties, and capacities, then the first step is to regain our property and property rights, and that's because property is the legal foundation of all of our liberties. Now let me teach you how to do just that in my business and profession school, which is now a compact disc for adult home school. Now for more information about my private business school, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package first. That's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's informative, it's entertaining. Remember, it's educational, and it's free of charge. You can call right now to order yours. The number is 417-273-4967, and my business school is also available on compact disc for adult home study. So if you're online, just go to the website, georgegordon.org. Click onto the email, send me an email request for the free general law CD package, or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about gangs, the Hispanic gangs in America. You know, Michael Barron's Italian-Mexican comparison also ignores the differences between the U.S. economies of 1904 and 2004. While Italian dropouts back in 1904 could make their way into the middle class by working in the booming manufacturing sector of the economy or applying their existing craftsman skills, it is far more difficult today given the decline of factory jobs and the rise of the knowledge-based economy, as the limited education of Mexican Americans depresses their wages. Their sense of being stuck in an economic backwater breeds resentment. The second generation becomes angry with America as they see their fathers faltering and failing. This is an observation that Cesar Barrios, an outreach worker for the Tapayac Association, has observed. He's a social services agency and agent for Mexicans in New York City. Now, this resentment only increases the lure of underclass culture with its rebellious rejection of conventional norms. For this reason, Barrows says, many young Mexicans prefer to imitate blacks rather than to imitate white people. Chicago provides a cautionary tale about high levels of Hispanic immigration combined with an ever more powerful underclass ethic. During the 1990s, the Hispanic population in Chicago grew 38% to 754,000 and became increasingly concentrated in the city's barrios. Education levels and fluency in English dropped dramatically, and while it became lower and lower, while serious crime, social disorder, and physical decay grew in direct proportion to the number of Spanish-speaking Latinos. After a neighborhood became more than 60% Latino, physical decay, including graffiti, trash-filled vacant lots and abandoned automobiles jumped disproportionately. So that by 2001, social pathology among Spanish-speaking Latinos was higher than for any other racial or ethnic group. There are many counterexamples that show a salutary effect of Hispanic immigration. Santa Ana, California, at 76% Latino, the most heavily Spanish-speaking city of its size in this country, has cleaned up the seedy bars from its downtown area and replaced them with palm trees and benches, in large part thanks to a newly created business environment district or an improvement district. Many homes in Santa Ana's wealthier Mexican neighborhoods sport exuberant roses and bougainvilleas in their front yards, and students that I spoke to there wanted to become lawyers, architects, medical technicians. In predominantly Mexican East Los Angeles, housing prices are soaring along with the rest of Southern California's housing market. A 1928 two-bedroom, one-bath bungalow with a lawn gone to seed was listed at $265,000 this past April, and in increasingly Hispanic South Central Los Angeles, tiny bogas selling milk, diapers, and piñatas are replacing liquor stores. Yet, a seemingly innocuous block in Santa Ana can host 5 to 8 households dedicated to gang banging or drug sales. A front yard may be relatively trash-free. Inside the house, a different matter entirely. So says Santa Ana cop Kevin Ruiz. He's been to 3 houses just this week where they made a mountain of trash in the backyard or changed their baby's diaper by throwing it over the couch. They don't use the indoor plumbing while letting their dogs go to the bathroom on the carpet. Ruiz drives by the modest tract home where his Mexican father, who worked in Orange County's farming industry, raised him in the 1950s. A car with a shattered windshield, a trailer, a minivan sit in the backyard, surrounded by piles of junk and a mattress leaning against the garage door. My mother taught us that even if you're poor, you should be neat and clean, he says, shaking his head. 50-year-old men are still dressing like cholos, Chicano gangsters, Ruiz says, and fathers are ordering barbers to shave their young sons bald in good gang tradition. Without prompting, Ruiz brings up the multi-million-dollar question. He says, I don't see assimilation. They want to hold on to their Hispanic culture. Ruiz thinks that today's Mexican immigrant is a totally different kind of person from the past. Some come with a chip on their shoulder toward the United States, he says, which they blame for political and economic failure, the failure of their home countries, rather than aggressively seizing the opportunities available to them, especially in education. They have learned to play the victim card, he says. Ruiz advocates a much more aggressive approach. We need to explain, we'll help you assimilate up to a certain point, but then you have to take advantage of what's here. Ruiz's observation will strike anyone who has hired eager Mexican and Central American workers as incredible. I pressed him repeatedly, insisting that Americans see Mexican immigrants as cheerful, hard-working, but he was adamant. They're creating an underclass, he maintained. Immigration optimists, ever ready to trumpet the benefits of today's immigration wave, have refused to acknowledge its costs. Foremost among them are skyrocketing gang crime and an expanding underclass. And until the country figures out how to reduce these costs, maintaining the current open border regime is total folly. We should enforce our immigration laws and select immigrants on skills and likely upward mobility, not success in sneaking across the border. Well, we're dealing here with Bible prophecy, boys and girls, so let's take a look at it. There are two key chapters in the scripture that deal with this exact problem. It's Leviticus chapter 26 and Deuteronomy chapter 28. Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28, the whole chapters. The first 14 verses of each chapter, God tells us, here's what I'm going to do for you. If you'll sit down, shut up, fold your hands, and do what I tell you. We gave him the finger, stood up, and won't do anything that he tells us. So he said, okay, no problem. Here's what's going to happen to you. And then from verses 14 through the ends of the chapter, he says, here's the way I'm going to deal with you. In speaking of this immigrant problem, the stranger that is within you shall get up above you very high, and you shall come down very low. He shall lend to you, you shall not lend to him. He shall be the head, and you shall be the tail. Now, that speaks of two classes of persons here. You've got the blacks and Hispanics. In fact, you've got all of the aliens. What the Bible calls the heathen nations around you that he told us not to make any covenants with, no contracts, don't participate with, and don't deal with. Separate yourselves from them, he instructed us, our Anglo-Saxon forefathers, but we knew better than God. So back in 1962, we enacted a new immigration law. And we decided that what we were going to do in America was to open our borders to every nation in the world, and we have. And today, we white Anglo-Saxons now number 68% of the population. 32%. Now we're right at a third. Right at a third. One-third of the people in this country are foreigners, aliens, non-white. Now, in 1960, it was 90% white and 10% all others. Today, it's 68% white and 32% all others. How do you think this is going to play out now when these all others represent 50% of the population? Don't you think they're going to take over? Which is precisely what we've been told here. The stranger that's within you shall get up above you and bring you down very low. It's happening. You're observing it. You're mad as hell about it. There's nothing you can do. And that's exactly right. There is something you can do, but there's nothing being done. The answer is you have to obey God and keep His commandments. That will trigger Exodus 23:20-24. I'll be an enemy to your enemies and an adversary to your adversaries. We Americans have stood by while our scriptures and our God have been thrown out of our public schools. Well, okay. But why do you send your children to those same public schools where God has been thrown out? Well, there are some people in America, a couple, 3 million, who have taken their children out of the public schools and are now educating them at home to this law. He goes on to make one more observation here. He says, moreover, all of these curses shall come upon you and shall pursue you and overtake you until you be destroyed because you hearkened not unto the voice of the Eternal your God to keep His commandments and His statutes which He commanded you. Well, if we don't want to practice God's commandments, statutes, and judgments, then we can expect the kind of strangers within our gates to bring us down very low, can't we? You've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week on the Internet. For more information about the Gordon Law School and The Law Hour, please go to my website. That's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. Hey, there's the signal. It says my time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.